Welcome to Blind Line for the 29th of January 2000. My name's Jonathan Mosen. Thank you for joining us. We're just about at the end of the first month of the last year of the millennium, so we're getting there, aren't we? Well, on the program today we have an ACB radio special report, the Unified Braille Code. This goes for around about an hour and a half, and it's a comprehensive look at the UBC, the Unified Braille Code. We'll get to that in just a moment. After that, it'll be your opportunity to give us a ring and tell us what you think about the UBC or any other issue that you think is important to the blind community. You can do that via buddy phone or via the telephone, and we'll give you the details after our special report. But without any further ado, here is that UBC special report. Braille. It's the only path to true literacy for the blind. It's about effective written communication. Yet communication is hindered by the variations of literary Braille around the English-speaking world, the fact that there are special codes for specific technical subjects, and that those technical subjects are written in a number of totally dissimilar ways around the world. The answer, almost everyone agrees, is to have one code for all Braille with the exception of music, and for that one code to be used by all English-speaking countries, a unified Braille code. That, however, is about where the unity ends. 9 years after work on a unified Braille code began, passions are running hot, friendships have been irrevocably damaged, and observers are left wondering whether this laudable goal is an unattainable pipe dream. Chris Gray is president of the Braille Revival League, an affiliate of the consumer organisation the American Council of the Blind. He also represented the Council on the Braille Authority of North America for over a decade. Chris explains the genesis of the Unified Braille Code, UBC.
The way this all got started, really, is that there began to be a great deal of criticism of Braille in the United States, because we have the base literary code, and then in addition to the base, for many, many years, actually beginning in 1951, we had the Nemeth Code. It took the Nemeth Code until 1964 to really become widespread. So for a long time we had the Taylor Code for mathematics, the Nemeth Code for mathematics, and literary Braille. During the 60s, the Taylor Code went away. We had Nemeth. But by the early 1970s, the computer was coming along. The computer was very much in vogue, helping blind people get new jobs. And so there was created an extension to the Nemeth Code for representing computer notation. It was a provisional code, never adopted. And in the early 1980s, it was replaced by the computer Braille code that was finally adopted by the Braille Authority of North America in 1986. In addition to those codes, there came to be what was called the textbook code. Now, it wasn't really a code exactly. It was a way of more formally presenting textbook material, showing the print page, showing tables in a more organized fashion than the literary code, but people thought of it as a code. And as people began to be more involved in sciences other than mathematics, the Nemeth Code was changed and added to for things like ancient numeration systems. Raised line diagrams came to have a set of guidelines put out by the Braille Authority of North America, and in more recent times, the draft of a chemistry code, and now a chemistry code, was created. And so, as time has gone on, and as the needs of Braille readers have changed and magnified, as our employment and our social status magnified, we came to a crossroads where the question had to be asked, can we live with all these disparate ways of doing things, these various codes or provisional codes or formats or guidelines and heaven knows what else, and this is only in the Braille Authority of North America. The Braille Authority of the UK has its own series of code books and methodologies for doing things. Tim Cranmer and Abe Nemeth at the request of the Braille Authority of North America, a request which I was very influential in having the Braille Authority make to them, brought forth a paper which suggested that they had some ideas and felt there was a very distinct possibility of creating what was called a unified Braille code. A code that could take the basic current literary system and bind it together with mathematics, with science, with textbook formats, with computer codes and computer needs and languages, and come up with something which was in fact a code that worked from the bottom up, that you would learn a symbol and that symbol would be the same from the beginning to the end of your learning days, and that your learning could then grow and become broader and larger, but you would not have to learn and then unlearn a Braille code to relearn some other intellectual discipline.
Joe Sullivan is president of Duxbury Systems, the company that produces the Duxbury Braille translation software. He's also the chairman of what is arguably the most influential committee in the UBC project. From his perspective as a producer of Braille translation software, he can see another disadvantage of the present disunified state of Braille in English-speaking countries.
There's also an impact on transcribers and the transcription process, including computerized transcription, which in turn drives up the price of Braille, and that means in turn that the Braille is less available. So on all counts, that system is felt to be to be a disservice to readers. The feeling was that it could be unified. There should be a bringing together of these codes so that there is one way of representing a dollar sign for one thing and treating text in general without worrying about specifically what kind of text it is.
Bruce McGuire runs his own Braille production company, Brailleways, and represents Australia at the International Council on English Braille. He rates Drs. Abe Nemeth and Tim Cramner's memo on the need for a unified Braille code as an important moment in the history of Braille.
Because it articulates very well the problems that we have with our kind of plethora of current codes. And although the paper was written in a US context, nevertheless the issues that the paper raised were very much applicable to most countries where English Braille is used. That is, you have one sign in literary Braille to represent a particular symbol, you have a different sign in mathematics, a different sign again in computing, and in some cases yet another sign in chemistry. So I think the paper resonated with the thinking of a lot of people in different countries, and I think it was really for that reason that the ICUB felt that this project had implications that went beyond the geographical jurisdiction of any one Braille authority.
We invited both architects of that historic paper to appear on this program to discuss whether they're happy with the way their vision for Braille is being turned into an actual code ready for use. Dr. Tim Cramner declined our invitation, saying he wasn't prepared to dignify with further discussion what he considers to be the objections of a few radicals to the mathematical provisions of UBC. Dr. Abraham Nemeth, inventor of the Nemeth Braille Code used for mathematics in the USA and some other countries, looks at the 1991 memo he co-wrote with Tim Cramner with the benefit of hindsight.
I recently had occasion to review that letter, and I'm still proud of it, and it points up very clearly what we need. The literary code did not provide any mechanism for doing anything other than straight word after word. And so when it was necessary to do mathematics, chemistry, any other kind of science, the new codes had to be retrofitted onto the literary code. And when you retrofit something onto a code instead of building a design into it, there are inevitable conflicts. So, for example, we found that the dollar sign was one thing in the literary code. It was a second thing in the computer code. It was a third thing in the Nemeth code. And that was also true of exclamation points and other symbols. And that created a kind of an impasse. People couldn't learn all of those idiosyncrasies, couldn't change their hats as often as was necessary to understand what they were reading. And so it occurred to Dr. Cranmer and I, who were and are good friends, to push for the development of a unified, in those days we call it uniform, a uniform Braille code, we wrote. Somehow or other, spontaneously, the word uniform got changed to unified. There was no rationale or philosophy why the word got changed, but it got changed. And I'm not one to quibble about little matters of that kind. And we submitted this to BANA. And in due course, BANA invited both Dr. Cranmer and me to come to Albuquerque, New Mexico, to present our case, which we did. And we were politely asked to stay outside while the BANA board deliberated what we offered them. And in a short time, they adopted the motion to proceed with the project right then and there. And so we went home feeling elated. Now, that was in 1991. The first meeting of the Ad Hoc Committee, as we called it, this is the Uniform Braille Code Project Committee, and we called it the Ad Hoc Committee, with Darlene Bogart as chairman, and at that time she was also chairman of BANA. We had a meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina, immediately following the national conference of the National Braille Association. We always meet in connection with other organizations so that some of the people will only have one fare to incur instead of two, and one hotel bill to incur instead of two, and so on. So we met in Charlotte, and at that time I proposed a paper called A Philosophical Basis for a Uniform Braille Code, and it had 15 guidelines in it. And we discussed it around the table, and the committee declined to let itself be bound by those guidelines. And they also declined to let itself be bound by any other set of guidelines. And so we began to craft a code from 1992 till 1995, very much like a bunch of 11-year-olds would get together, you know, bright 11-year-olds, to build a submarine. Now, I would let you decide whether you would care to take the first ride in that submarine. And that's how the whole thing got started.
But Joe Sullivan disagrees.
That's definitely not the case. In fact, there is was an extensive document prepared by BANA, by the board of BANA, outlining, for one thing, a set of principles that should apply to UBC. For example, the non-ambiguity, the fact that it would be six-dot code, and that it would adhere as closely as possible to the present literary code, and a whole string of principles. I should mention, by the way, that all of this history, including that, including those principles and so on, can be found if a person goes to the ICEB website. That's www.iceb.org, and follow the links from there to the UBC project. There is a particularly the committee 2. I haven't actually got the other committees as yet loaded up, but there's an entire history there of how the debate proceeded, and going right back to the beginnings, back to the 1992 original documents, and one can follow, you know, see where what the principles were and how the debate proceeded day by day by simply examining all that material. I don't say it's simple, by the way. You have to download a zip file and unzip it and then read, wade through lots and lots of text to do that, but it's all there, and there's absolutely no question that the project as a whole is very well grounded in principles, and that we have followed those principles very faithfully as we proceed. Now, I think what Dr. Nemeth may be referring to are some papers that he put up, you know, as part of that debating process that he wanted us to adopt, and of course, they were consistent, like everything else. There were proposals by all of us at various points. And, you know, none of us got all of our ideas accepted, and none of us got them all turned down either. There was definitely a democratic process that we followed.
While much of the rest of this program is devoted to matters of detail within the proposed UBC, as Chris Gray points out, there are some who want their Braille kept just the way it is.
As soon as the word got around in ACB that a UBC was being considered, there was considerable opposition by the older population who didn't have to deal with any Braille except literary Braille. And I don't think they were so opposed to a UBC as they were fearful of a change that was happening that they didn't understand. I know I went to a lot of Braille Revival League meetings when I was representing ACB on the Braille Authority of North America, and had to answer a lot of pointed questions. Why do we need change? Why isn't Braille good enough the way it is today? And people who don't deal with codes on a day-to-day basis had forgotten that in the literary Braille code, for example, there is no plus sign. If you encounter a plus sign and you're transcribing in literary code, you cannot recreate that symbol. You have to write the word PLUS. I could go on for the next 20 minutes about inadequacies of the base literary code. Well, blind folks don't worry about that stuff. If they learned a plus sign and they want to write plus, they write the plus sign. And so there's a big difference between the code that must be transcribed in a book and the code that an individual uses. And when you begin talking with folks about Braille at that level, then they realize that, oh yes, there is a problem that I don't face, but the transcriber faces, and that is faced in grade schools and high schools and more academic environments. So yeah, I think there was some opposition and there was a great deal of concern. And there is still today, and I'm more sympathetic to this now than I used to be. There is today a belief that a unified Braille code is a great idea and a stupid thing to try and do because it will never work.
Other countries became interested in the concept of UBC, so that quickly the task had widened from creating one American unified Braille code to creating a unified Braille code for all English-speaking countries.
There was another agenda going on at the same time. There had been two international conferences and a great deal of work done to try and create more readability between United Kingdom and North America authority using countries. And so people began saying, well, we really ought to internationalize this project, and it's important to bring all the world who uses English Braille along with us. Otherwise, we're undoing the work that we began with the first of the new international conferences that was held in 1981 at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
And so work on UBC began in earnest. So how different from Grade 2 as we know it today is UBC for literary Braille readers? Bruce McGuire.
One of the aims of the project that was originally developed by the aims were developed by the Braille Authority of North America, and which were taken over by, or at least adopted by the ICB, was that the proposed new code should make as few changes to existing Grade 2 Braille as possible. And so, for the average reader of literary Braille, that is a reader, and I'm assuming for the moment that average reader means someone who isn't reading primarily mathematics, that he's reading sort of Braille, say for novels, for literature, maybe recipes, magazines, there would in fact be few changes. There would be a few contractions that would be that we're proposing to delete, such as the TO contractions, such as the COM contraction, double D contraction, maybe the TO contraction, we're not quite, you know, we haven't quite finalized that yet. There'd be a few changes with some of the rules, for example, words like and for of the with would no longer be spaced to the following word. Would no longer be joined to words like a or for. And there'd be a few new symbols, such as there'd be a new symbol for the dash and a new symbols for opening and closing brackets. But essentially, readers who are familiar with current grade 2 literary braille, whether it's used in England, the US, Canada, New Zealand, or Australia, would find it very easy to adapt to the new code. In fact, we've demonstrated this in workshops that we've held around Australia, and there's an excellent article that was produced by Joe Sullivan back in 1995 called A Brief Introduction to UBC, and that's actually written in the Unified Braille Code. And we found in conducting workshops that it's in many cases taken readers quite a long time to realise that in fact they're reading UBC, not current grade 2 braille. So I think anyone who has fears or misgivings that they will be required to learn a completely new code in order to read literary braille can rest easy, because that is certainly not the case.
Joe Sullivan outlines additional changes.
Probably the first thing they'll notice is that the parentheses are different. I think that might be the most common ones. Then they might, when they see a fully capitalized heading, notice three dot sixes to tell us that the whole passage is capitalized. That might be another one of the more common new things. But I suspect the punctuation, the parentheses specifically, not other punctuation marks, but the parentheses will jump out as different, because the old lower G's, of course, are not usable in mathematics and so on, where you really need to know whether it's an opening or closing parentheses. That was something obvious to everyone that we had to change. So if you're interested, we came up with a .5 GH for the opening and .5 AR sign for the closing. And parentheses are common enough that people will run into that.
Bill Poole is chairman of the Braille Authority of the United Kingdom, but agreed to come on this program to express some personal views. He has a number of concerns about UBC as it affects literary braille readers.
In relation to contractions, for example, they're proposing to abolish all sequenced words. You won't be able to join up and for of the with. You won't be able to join up to, into, and by. And you'll lose, probably, those last contractions, because they can't be written by themselves without ambiguity. At least by can't. And so they are very valuable contractions. They take up a lot of... They save a lot of space in grade 2. And the result is a considerable loss in efficiency of the code, which in my view isn't necessary. I don't think that it conflicts with the principles of UBC to have that in. By contrast, there are contractions which are hardly ever used. And we did research in my country in 1980, which established what they were, contractions like thyself and rejoicing and so on, I mean, and conceive, which are hardly ever used, and no attempt is going to be made to prune those, although it's known that they constitute a significant burden to learners, especially people who are finding Braille difficult to learn for whatever reason. It seems to me perverse to be quite ready, in the interests of an abstract principle, to abolish contractions which are very valuable, while not wanting to do anything about contractions that are a clutter to learn, simply because the principles of UBC neither require you to have them nor not to have them, so they don't want to take up the issue. So I do think that in the area of contractions, that is something that I disagree with them about. And I also think that you need to be clear that there's a timetable for the implementation of UBC, such that all the important committees, including the contractions committee, will have to have submitted a final report by the end of June this year, and then other stages will be pursued. So between now and the end of June, there are things that we have an opportunity to alter if we can persuade the committees that there is enough desire on the part of ordinary Braille users that they should be altered, and that's one of the reasons why I'm keen to talk to you. Now, in relation to contractions, as you probably know, although we're calling this a unified code, which aims to make common standard throughout the English-speaking world, which is a noble ideal, and I support that. We are nevertheless proposing, we haven't solved the problem that the rules governing the use of contractions between North American countries and the UK and other countries also are different, and we're now beginning to address that question. For example, the Americans, and New Zealand comes under North American jurisdiction, as you know, they don't contract across syllables. For example, they wouldn't contract ED in reduce, whereas we would. We're much more liberal in the use of contractions. And I think, this is my personal view, that UBC's contraction rules should go much more in the direction of liberality, so that there'd be fewer exceptions to those rules than the Americans so far have wished to do. So that's something we're negotiating about, we'll have to see what the outcome is. There's another problem about contractions, which is very difficult, and it concerns the use of short forms, that is, contractions like about, above, according, across, those contractions, which are, some people call them abbreviations, but we call them short forms. And the position with regard to them is that the way they are constructed violates the rules of symbol construction of UBC. And therefore, also, it is in, existing translation software going from Braille to print won't translate them correctly often. For example, if you have the word Africa, it may read the AF as the word after, and so it will create a false word, Afterica. Now, we clearly have to do something to avoid that. And what is proposed to be done is that, in general, these short forms will only be able to be used by themselves as complete words. You won't be able to add anything to them except under special circumstances. So you might have a rule that says QK stands for quick. You can use it in quicker and quickest, but you can't use it in quickness and quicksilver. And that sort of apparently arbitrary distinction will apply to all the short forms, and there are 76 of them. And I think that is going to impose a memory burden on people when they're learning to write Braille correctly, which won't be attractive. Clearly, when Braille is produced automatically, these rules can be built in, and that's fine. But if you're writing, you know, privately, personally, yourself, you will have to know what the rules of correct writing are, and you'll probably be irritated by seeing these short forms sometimes appearing in your reading and sometimes not, for reasons that you won't necessarily clearly understand. That is a feature of the code which I think is regrettable, but I actually don't see a way of avoiding it. I think all we can do is to try to make it as straightforward as possible. There are other things besides contractions which I have reservations about in UBC. It's proposed that we should have what are called typeform indicators, which are signs to indicate bold, print, underlining, italics. We already have an italic sign, but it's going to be changed. And other print divergences, print face divergences, like whether it's in sans serif type or not. Now, these signs each take up two cells to open and close, and they will cause a lot of clutter. It's proposed that they should only be used when some important distinction is being made by their use, and that will be a matter of judgment for people. The danger is that because there is a way of representing boldface, people will tend to use it always or very often, and that will cause a lot of clutter in Braille. We've already been having in my country a lot of a debate over the introduction of capitals here. We've introduced a dual standard, as you probably know, whereby both capitalized and uncapitalized Braille are regarded as correct. And one of the main arguments that opponents of capitalization use is that capitals cause a lot of clutter. Now, these typeform indicators will cause even more clutter, and it just depends how people style their books. If they style them in such a way as to keep these things to a minimum, then that'll be all right. But if they don't, it won't. So that's another feature of the code that I take exception to.
Joe Sullivan says transcribers will be given guidelines as to when it's appropriate to use the new formatting information in UBC.
Yes, what's actually widely misunderstood is that while UBC does take pains to provide the means for showing all of the font information,
which is needed for technical accuracy when that information is significant. The rules actually are the same as for current literary Braille, in that we also tell you don't use those symbols when the information is not significant. So, for example, if bold is used in all of the headings throughout a document, then that's just a stylistic choice. It has no, it's not emphasis, but just a stylistic choice to do that. Then we would tell you don't use the bold indicators, which of course is exactly what you would not do if you were Braille in present literary Braille. It's the same in UBC. So we don't expect to see any more displaying of font information in a UBC text than is presently is presently the case in literary material. But we do give you the ability to tell you, for example, that it's underlined versus, say, italic or bold. Whereas, of course, literary material right now, you actually don't get that information. You simply have a general emphasis indicator. So in that sense, that it is a bit more accurate, but it has to be for technical purposes. Many books will deliberately use a font for one, an italic font for one purpose, and maybe a red letters for another purpose, and so on. And if that actually has significance, then of course it has to be shown in Braille, or the Braille reader is going to be missing that information.
Chris Gray is looking forward to having more information about formatting.
Because the unified Braille code, and incidentally I think any unified code, would have to adopt a system which is commonly referred to in the computer world as a prefix root system, could show lots and lots more formatting than is available in Braille today. And, a lot of formatting is used in print. My gosh, we have, as a technical writer, I can tell you, I deal with formats, seems like 80% of my professional life, but you've got, italics and bold italic, and all kind of different fonts and so forth. Format plays a big role in print in conveying information. It also plays a big role in print in conveying clutter and misinformation. A unified Braille code that could show any of these formats all put on top of each other will cause a great deal of learning difficulty, but I don't think that brings the code into total disrepute. It means that a good deal of work has to be done by a formats committee, and some common sense has to be imposed on the code. It does prove one thing, though, Jonathan, and that is that we're never going to have a totally machine-created code. If we did, we probably couldn't read it. Or if we had to wade through all the nonsense, we wouldn't care at the end what we were reading.
Many professionals or academics for whom this extra information is important are doing their own brailing, either to electronic devices or embossers. Joe Sullivan.
In many instances, the translation that's produced these days will actually be an automatic kind of process, not necessarily under direct control, point by point by a live person. And very often that process might well be under control of the blind reader who's going to read the material. So if the reader decides, heck, I really am interested in this font material, I don't care whether it's merely stylistic or not, then all I have to do is turn on all the options and all of that font information will come out. So it's basically the reader can decide that they want to see it. But I think that for our general transcription purposes, we would still suggest that it not be there, because otherwise a lot of people will be turned off by the clutter.
For all mathematics students, changes to the Braille code will be significant. The purpose of UBC is to abolish the various subject-specific codes, so codes like the Nemeth code and other maths codes used around the English-speaking world would be replaced by UBC. The Nemeth code uses lower numbers, thus avoiding the need for both number signs and letter signs in mathematical equations. UBC will require the use of both number signs and letter signs. In addition, mathematical symbols including plus, minus, divided by, and equals all take up two cells in UBC. For some in the US, this is utterly intolerable. Chris Gray.
It requires just a phenomenal number of number signs and letter signs. Here's the problem as I see it. Anyone who's been an Opticon learner will understand this concept instantly. Because with an opticon, you work so hard at first to get every letter. And by the time you're done getting every letter, for the first week or two, you're darn lucky if you've got the word in your mind by the time you've got done reading the letters, or the sentence by the time you've got done reading the words. And I personally believe that the unified Braille code of today is so cumbersome in terms of dots and shapes and characters to be read that a person will end up reading code and never getting down to the mathematical and scientific concepts that are the point of the whole exercise. Any unified code is going to be more massive than what we have today in North America. I can't speak to the UK in that regard. There's no question, though, that where unity comes, we must sacrifice a few cells here and there. But UBC has decided not to adopt a principle of as few extra cells as possible. And I think in there is an inherent flaw that really brings down the house.
Abe Nimes.
No one can live with upper numbers in mathematics. Letters, numbers are so crowded together that the switch from one to the other by using the same symbols for letters as for numbers is impractical. Consider a simple example. I don't think this will boggle anybody's mind. Consider a mathematical expression like 2a plus 3b. Well, in the unified Braille code now, each one of those characters requires two cells. The 2 because of the number sign, the a because of the letter sign, the plus because of the infinite wisdom, which I say in quotes, they decided to make a two-cell sign. And when we come to 3 and b, it has the same fate as the 2 and the a. And so we have 10 cells for 2a plus 3b. You can't do that in mathematics. Now, there are hundreds of transcribers in this country who say, let us use drop numbers in the literary code, and the NEMF code is already the uniform Braille code that you're looking for.
But Joe Sullivan says compactness is just one criterion that must be examined when designing this new code.
There's certainly been an attempt to keep things as compact as possible within the constraints of the other principles that are put forward. Compactness is, by the way, one of the principles that things not be expanded unreasonably. But one of the it's not just a question of number signs and letter signs, by the way, but also the fact that the code is intended to be unambiguous. In UBC, for example, we make darn sure that there's no way that a symbol can be misinterpreted. Whereas in other codes, there hasn't been quite as strong an attention to this. For example, in NEMF code, you have an equal sign is exactly the same symbol as the Greek letter kappa. And for that matter, since equations occur in a grade 2 context, an equal sign is really the same thing as the word knowledge italicized in the present NEMF code. So you really have a three-way ambiguity in that symbol. Granted, context usually makes it obvious, particularly if you already know mathematics, as to where a kappa might occur versus where an equal sign might occur. But there are, of course, many, many other examples. Many codes really take a rather less strict approach to ambiguity and the ambiguity issue than does UBC. UBC, though, because it worries a lot about ambiguity, has to be sure that it doesn't overload symbols so they have several meanings that could, in fact, be confused in a given situation, and which is what leads us to using multi-cell symbols in some cases. In fact, I think that the expansion of all this, when you get through with it, by the way, some things come out shorter in UBC than if I were to if we were to work through an example, but you can always make points with examples that are really can be misleading, as you know, because there's tons of examples you can bring up.
Given the sensitivity to unnecessary clutter in Britain, one would expect this issue to also be generating considerable debate there. Not so, according to Bill Poole.
I just have to tell you that in my country, that isn't a major issue, because We have no head of steam that advocates going onto Nemeth code numbers. As you know, in our computer code, we don't use Nemeth code numbers either. We use what I'd call continental numbers, where you add a dot six to the digits. And if in our country there was a move to remove clutter from mass, then I think that's the road down which the majority of our technical people would want to go. But that is the decision that was taken in November, and the traditional numbers should be the way that UBC represents all numbers. And it's not a big issue in my country.
Australians feel the same way, according to Bruce Maguire.
If you look at Braille readers at an international level, there are far more people who don't use the Nemeth code than who do. The Nemeth code is not used in Australia. It's not used in the UK. It's not used in many developing countries where English Braille is used. And so, whilst the Nemeth code is certainly used in the US and Canada and New Zealand, it is not used in so those other countries, and also in South Africa, it's not used. There is also, if you look at other Braille codes around the world, there is also a very strong preference for upper numbers in those braille codes. The way of writing numbers with a numeral sign and the letters A to J is very traditional and well established in braille codes throughout the world. And in some ways, it's the Nemeth code that is sort of the anomaly. Now, of course, There are people who use the Nemeth code. Many Braille users use the Nemeth code, and there's no doubt that in areas of mathematics and computing and chemistry, there will be quite substantial change for all readers, not just for people who use the Nemeth code, but also for people who use the British code and the Australian the Australian maths code. And I think that it comes down to kind of thinking, well, what is going to be ultimately in the best interests of Braille users throughout the world. And the fact is that I think one of the things that, for example, you can't do in current American Braille is to write a plus sign in literary Braille. In Britain and Australia and South Africa you can. And in the UBC you'll be able to use a plus sign regardless of its context. Currently you use a different plus sign in literary Braille in England and Australia from what you do in computing. That will all change in UBC. So there'll be essentially one symbol, one Braille symbol to represent a print sign regardless of the context. And sure, that is going to mean change, but I prefer to think of it in terms of the benefits that will accrue to Braille users in terms of ease of production, greater efficiency of production, an easier code to learn in the long run, an easier code to teach, and I think we've got to try as much as we can to think globally in these issues. There are many blind people in developing countries for whom Braille is something that they have to sacrifice to have. It's not the luxury, or it's not a kind of the right that we tend to think of it as in developed countries. And people really do sacrifice in these developing countries so that they can have Braille. And I think we've got in developed countries, we've got a moral and ethical responsibility to kind of consider the needs of our, blind brothers and sisters around the world. And if that means that we have to make changes that we ourselves might not always agree with or see the need for, then I think, we really do need to kind of try to adopt a global perspective.
But Chris Gray says Nemeth has proven itself and is growing in popularity.
Every Commonwealth country of any stature whatsoever in terms of its education and forward-moving activities has abandoned the upper number code that's used in the UK. Canada is a Braille Authority of North America user. So is New Zealand. And were it not for the discussion of a unified Braille code, we know for a fact that today Australia would vote to adopt the Nemeth code. Only because there is discussion of a unified code are they waiting. They will argue that an upper numbers system can be made to work. But they are unwilling, and I believe wholly unable, to substantiate that with any real factual material of any technical merit whatsoever. They know it, and that's why they don't want to do it. The UK itself, which is the greatest proponent of the upper number mathematical system, does not use an exclusively upper number system. For fractions and in certain other areas, they do use lower numbers. And so there isn't an English-speaking code in the world that is based on strictly upper numbers. And yet, our friends who are proposing a UBC expect us to swallow this and say it's a good idea.
Bruce Maguire says Australia was looking at Nemeth, but not because they considered it to be a superior code.
Well, last year, the Australian Braille Authority produced a paper called Braille 2000, Meeting the Challenges of a New Millennium. And we did that basically because we felt that Australia needs to make some fundamental changes in its Braille codes and practices. We use a literary Braille code that essentially is the British code, but it uses capitals. We have a maths code that, whilst derived from the British code, has certainly nevertheless gone its own way in the last sort of 20 years or so, mainly as a result of the different needs, as we perceive them, of mainstreamed sort of blind students. We use the American computer code, and we have our own chemistry code. So we have quite a diverse range of Braille codes that have been developed to kind of meet the unique needs of Australian Braille users. But, you know, in a time when kind of, you know, things are becoming more internationalized, it's really kind of reaching the point where we feel we needed to make some fundamental changes. Now, we considered a range of options. We considered just adopting all of the British codes. We considered adopting all of the US codes, including Nemeth. We included doing nothing, and we included as one of our options the adopting the UBC, and overwhelmingly we came to the conclusion that the unified Braille code would have the most benefits for Australian Braille users, and so our preferred option was to adopt the unified Braille code. We recognised, though, that coming up to the ICB General Assembly, there was no a clear view at the time that we were developing the paper, which was in kind of early 1999, as to what the ICB assembly would do in relation to UBC. Certainly the project had appeared to have lost some of its inertia, and we recognised that we had to consider the possibility that the UBC may not be adopted, or a decision might be taken basically to kind of close the project. And so we then looked for an alternative strategy that we could start thinking about, and our alternative was to adopt the American Braille codes and practices, which would have included adopting the American Literary Braille Code, the American Textbook Formatting Code, and the Nemeth Code, just as in fact you did in New Zealand, and it was done in Canada. The reasons that we came to that decision had nothing to do with the precise nature of the code itself. We didn't, for example, go through the Nemeth code from cover to cover and compare it with our existing code. We looked at more global issues like what's going to be easier for Braille producers in Australia to produce. Where is the software coming from that drives Braille production? And the answer is, well, it's not coming from Britain. It's not coming from South Africa. It's coming from the US. Where is most of the, well, a large quantity of Braille mathematical material produced? The answer, US. And where are all the teaching materials produced? The answer, US. So our decision to kind of to adopt the American codes had nothing to do with our beliefs about their relative merits or disadvantages. It had to do with things like which codes were going to be easier to teach, which, you know, because of the range of teaching materials. See, at the moment, any resource materials relating to Braille codes in Australia have to be developed in Australia, and that's a very expensive and time consuming process, and we just don't have the resources, either human or economic, to kind of, you know, develop that range of resource materials. And so we were looking at what was going to benefit the interests of Braille, you know, as Braille users. We did, in fact, recognise that there were some disadvantages in adopting the Nemeth, you know, the Nemeth code. One of which was that you know, if the Nemeth code were changed in the US, we would have to make similar changes sort of in Australia, and we would lose that control of code development that we currently, you know, that we currently have. But we felt, all things, you know, other things being equal, that it was more important for us to be part of an international Braille movement than to kind of, you know, maintain a splendid isolationist policy. At the ICB General Assembly, it became clear that there was a renewed commitment and enthusiasm for the Unified Braille Code, and because we basically believe that the Unified Braille Code is going to benefit all Braille users, including those in Australia, we felt it was more important for us to kind of wait a few more years to see the ultimate outcome. It would clearly not be in the interest of Braille users in Australia for us to adopt a new set of codes in 2001, only to find that in 2004, 2005, everybody was adopting another set of codes, i.e. the UBC. So that's essentially why we've taken the decisions that we have.
Chris Gray is adamant that the decision to go with upper numbers is politically motivated.
It was believed that if the international English Braille-using community were to be wooed sufficiently to come along with what was happening in North America, that there had to be a series of strictly political decisions made regarding Braille. The primary political decision that had to be made was that we would agree to go with strictly upper numbers. And for that reason, and I believe for that reason primarily, the Unified Braille Code that we have today is an upper number based code. And I say that's the fly in the ointment because if you look at the weakened position that Braille has come to be in, never mind your Braille build, never mind your greater Braille availability, when it comes down to teaching children and training teachers who teach children, Braille is still in a terribly weak situation. It's hard to say that in the United States or in the U.S. and Canada, it's feasible to throw away over 50 years of hard work in creating a system that we have believed up until now is better, based on lower numbers for mathematics and science, and go back those 50 years and try and formulate something which is a code based on upper numbers.
Bill Poole says there's little support for lower numbers internationally because if the Nemeth code became a part of UBC, we'd all notice big change.
One of the things we would feel about adopting Nemeth code numbers is that it would involve significant changes to punctuation signs, and that would be a major deviation from current literary Braille. It would certainly make UBC literary Braille less familiar to people than it currently is. It would add significantly to the deviancy of UBC literary Braille from the standard, the present standard. And that is one of the reasons why in our country we wouldn't go for lower numbers.
Joe Sullivan feels confident the majority are happy.
I'm afraid I don't see the groundswell. I tend to hear more from people around the world, I mean, than necessarily just in the United States. So for everyone I hear say we can't do things with upper numbers, we must have lower numbers or some other form, I tend to hear two or three other people say, well, I'm glad you got, you know, you're using ordinary upper numbers. But you know, I can't say I've taken a poll or anything scientific like that. There certainly are some people who feel very strongly about it, that there ought to be lower numbers, and there are, by the way, a number of people also who feel that we made a mistake by not choosing the European numbers or .6 numbers also, as you know, there's a cadre there who feels that that would have been the right choice. Indeed, I understand their beliefs. If you follow my advice and go back and trace through the very lengthy debates, which ran several months, by the way, there were two debates, I might add, on numbers. First, when we were just the four banner members, and then later in the eight-person committee, the second one being even longer. If you go back and look at that, you'll find that I advocated the .6 type numbers in the committee for many of the same reasons that are being brought forward now for the lower numbers, actually, and were at that time. The debate went on and on. You know, we heard all of these arguments over and over, sometimes, you know, from outside as well as certainly from inside the committee. And in the end, the decision really wasn't that close, certainly not for lower numbers. It was really 7-1 for upper numbers over lower numbers. And by the way, the people in the committee, certainly you can easily guess that Abe Nemeth was the one who voted for lower numbers. But the other people in the committee are also, by and large, very technically knowledgeable people. So it's not a question of ignoring the technical issues and the reasons that are, you know, still being brought forward for using lower numbers. And I tend to accept that I really do feel that the best answer came out, even though there isn't any perfect answer. That's, I think, what is frustrating people. Yes, there are problems with upper numbers. But so also are problems with the other two systems. And when all the smoke clears, I think that the best answer really was the one we arrived at. And I have to point out too that, interestingly enough, we came back to the same answer that Louis Braille himself came back to. And not just because we admire Louis Braille, of course we do, but not just for that reason, but because, in fact, when you look at the whole system, and also at literature and what really happens in literature as a whole, not just technical literature, the upper numbers do tend to make a lot of sense.
But according to Chris Gray, there's no evidence that Louis Braille supported upper numbers.
Well, I'm sorry to say it, but Joe Sullivan's got it wrong, because Louis Braille did not endorse an upper numbering system, and there's a good deal of evidence that, in fact, he may have been in favor of a lower number system as the Nemeth Code uses today.
With upper numbers being affirmed once again by the ICEB General Assembly in 1999, there remains a legacy of bitterness about process. Abe Nemeth.
When there was a call for papers in 1995, in preparation for the ICEB meeting in London in that year, there was a call for papers, and I wrote a paper. Chris Gray, who was a delegate to BANA at that time, was designated as a delegate to that conference, and he agreed to read a summary of my paper. My paper was neither accepted nor rejected, and on the day before the London conference, the executive committee of ICEB decided that my paper would not be presented. Now, my paper was professionally written. It had no invectives, it had no bad language, it didn't malign anyone, and I regard that rejection as sheer arrogance on the part of ICEB. That paper should have become a part of the regular proceedings, and it should have been read. It was not.
That decision was a defining moment for Chris Gray.
That told me that there was not going to be a free and open discussion, that all points of view were not going to be allowed to be presented. I didn't really care if Abe's viewpoint got adopted. I figured even if we made the presentation, it probably wouldn't get adopted. But to not even have the ability, as a Committee 2 member, to have your paper a part of the official record of an international conference and to have your point of view expressed, regardless of the committee decisions that had been taken and might be taken in the future, showed me the lack of disregard for individuals and for the merit of any particular idea that was held by the members of ICEB. It was a real shock to me, and I couldn't believe that they would have taken that decision. And many, many ICEB people came to me and gave me their personal apologies and asked me to convey those apologies back to the author of the paper. And yet there was nothing we could do to change it.
Bruce McGuire.
I think the feeling was in 1995, and I wasn't involved in any of the decision-making process then, so I'm not privy to all of the discussions that took place. But I think the feeling was that even in 1995, the issue of numbers had been exhaustively dealt with by Committee 2, and that the paper that Abe had written did not essentially add to the debate that had already taken place by Committee 2, and that its presentation would not provide information that hadn't already been provided and been discussed by Committee 2. I always think it's better to err on the side of freedom of expression, you know, and allowing people the forum to express their views. But equally, I can understand in some ways the frustration that people were experiencing, that there was a feeling that, you know, they were trying to finish a project at that time by 1996 to keep to the initial time frame. The Committee 2 had considered the numbers issue on at least two occasions, and I think it was probably three, prior to 1995. There was a need to move forward, and I think it was felt that moving forward process was not going to be facilitated by the presentation of another paper which essentially revisited issues that had already been dealt with. And I think at the 1999 General Assembly, a resolution was taken reaffirming Committee 2's decision in relation to the numbers question. And essentially what that basically means is, look, the issue has been discussed, and discussed again. There's nothing further going to be achieved by reopening that discussion. There is a need at some point to say, well, okay, we have to move forward from here. We can't spend the rest of our lives talking about upper versus lower numbers.
But Abe Nemeth is adamant.
In my teaching days, I was once assigned to teach a required course of mathematics to a group of social science majors. They didn't relish mathematics very much, but they had to take it. And I taught them about convergent and divergent series. And finally, I put before them the harmonic series, 1 plus a half plus a third plus a quarter plus a fifth and so on. And the question is, does it converge or does it diverge? Well, I said, since you are social science majors, let's discuss it a little bit and then put it to a vote. There were 13 people in the class, and at the end of the discussion, 8 people voted that it converged and 5 that it diverged. And then I went to the board and I put a proof on the board that it diverged. And I said, since you are social science majors, my lesson to you is this. You don't put things to a vote when somebody knows the answer. You put things to a vote only when nobody knows the answer. The committee voted to use upper numbers, and they voted several times to use upper numbers. It doesn't matter to me whether they voted 6 times or 8 times. It's wrong each time. I know the answer, and anybody with sense knows the answer. And if you saw the examples that I put in that paper, some of them overflowed, a simple example overflowed a 40-cell line. No one in that committee showed me how to rectify that situation. How would I put that example into Braille? No one ever did show me that. Now, recently, last year, I was asked by the National Braille Association to write an article for their bulletin. And in the UBC code, so I wrote a complete article of the UBC code, which contained both narrative material and notational material. And I called it helping paper creep. When you roll a page up and down in a Braille writer, the paper has a tendency to creep, and particularly when you are doing a long division problem and you roll the paper up where the quotient is to put the next term or next digit in there, and then roll it back down to the current work area, the paper tends to creak, and eventually the new braille and the old braille merge and you can't read either one. So I made a proposal to put the new terms not above the quotient, but in the margin alongside the next partial product. And then when you're all through, you have all the terms there and you can assemble them and, if you wish, put them above the quotient. And that sells paper creep. And I wrote a literary explanation about that, but it was in the UBC code. But then I wrote the example. And I will... I don't think anybody's mind is going to be boggled by a simple example. The divisor was 2x plus 3y. And the dividend was 8x cubed plus 27y cubed. And that example did not fit across a 40-cell Braille line. It took 44 cells to do it. And if it had been A's and B's instead of X's and Y's, and the letter side would have been required, it would have taken 51 cells. No one has yet showed me how to sensibly put that example into Braille in the UBC code.
It's felt by opponents of UBC that the reason why there isn't some more objection to it is that insufficient people have been exposed to the code. Chris Gray discusses the evaluation of UBC that took place some years ago.
As early as 1996, the Braille Revival League began asking the Unified Braille Code Project Committee to supply specific information about research they were doing on different numbering systems. To date, their requests have never even elicited a serious letter from the UBC Project Committee. A large survey was done in the United States and Canada, allegedly a socially scientific survey. I could take a whole hour program with you, Jonathan, and tell you point by point how that survey is statistically flawed from beginning to end. The project committee's answer is to say, yes, well, it does have flaws. I guess we really can't do surveys. We better just move ahead with the Unified Braille Code, which is what we all know we need. A lot of folks wrote in and asked to participate and to be involved in a scientific evaluation of more scientific material, in other words, than the sort of ephemeral stuff that's been passed around to date in UBC. There is not going to be a scientific survey according to what was decided in November of 1999. So there really hasn't been a process. There's been the vague appearance of a process which has gone more and more by the wayside over time. People hope that we'll forget that we don't care about these things, and that just isn't the case. At least I hope it isn't the case. I certainly care.
However, those involved with UBC say that it was more important to give people a chance to look at the code and have their say than to do a statistically rigorous survey. Joe Sullivan.
The evaluation was actually, in some sense, to the detriment of the scientific nature of it. You know, if you're running a scientific poll, you use a random sample and you go out and try to enforce that sample. You don't allow self-selection. But because of the widespread interest, the decision was taken at the early stages to actually make the evaluation process open to anybody. So anyone who wished to take on the evaluation could do that. I'm afraid I don't have the numbers at the top of my head. Because I was so involved with the design process, made it a point to be rather distant from the evaluation process myself. But in any case, I understand that the numbers were pretty large. How a statistician would evaluate all that, I don't know. But the anyone who wanted to say anything about it could join up and get an evaluation packet and say what they pleased. And I was a little worried about this, honestly, because it concerned me that when people are against something, they tend to get, you know, just human nature to become vociferous about it, whereas people who like what you've done tend to say, oh, that's great, and go on about doing something else, you know. So it worried me a little that the self-selection was allowed, but so I was pleased when I heard later that, well, self-selection or not, samples were fairly large, and in fact, the overall opinions were quite favorable. to UBC, not necessarily to every little bit of it. You know, everybody has some little thing to find with it, including myself at times. But overall, it was well accepted, and that was very encouraging.
Britain has been widely criticized for only having around 20 people participate in the last evaluation of UBC, but Bill Poole says the evaluation then was deliberately underplayed.
I think in no country did the number of evaluators exceed 300, so the number of it's quite a low proportion anyway. I don't know on what principle they were selected in other countries. We need to draw a distinction between the evaluation questionnaire itself and the adequacy of that and the issue that you've raised, which is the number of people who participated. Now, we took the following view in our country, and we took it quite sort of consciously and after debate, and we told our colleagues in other countries that this was what we were going to do. We took the view that there were important elements of UBC that hadn't yet been finally fixed. I've given you some examples. The treatment of short forms is one. The way you switch into and out of foreign languages is another. And there are others. We took the view that because these things hadn't been fixed and the rules governing contractions, whether we'd follow an American or a British model, that's quite important because that makes a lot of difference to how ordinary people would perceive their new Braille. We said as the code is not finalized in important respects, we must evaluate it on a pilot basis only, and when it has been finalized effectively, as it will have been by June of this year, then we can put it out for major public consultation and see what our people think about it. I think that was basically the right way to go, because you're going to have a situation in other countries where people are going to find things which they weren't expecting to find, and they may think them quite significant, and they're going to say, in the stuff I evaluated, it didn't have those things, and now you're asking us, when we supported the code without those things, you're now asking us to support the code with these things, and it isn't a level playing field. And I think that's a problem which you will encounter in countries which didn't take the view that we did. So that's why we had so few people, and we do propose to expose the public more widely to it after June of this year. That's the way we intend to deal with that.
And indeed, many Braille producers around the world will be publishing some articles in UBC to give as many Braille readers as possible the chance to look at it and comment on it. But for some, UBC is beyond redemption, and other plans are afoot. Chris Gray.
We believe that while it's easy to criticize, it's easy to say the work you've done is lacking in merit, or it isn't robust, or, well, we said a whole lot of other stuff about it, which I probably shouldn't repeat here. But, you know, it's one thing to critique. It's another thing to create something of your own that you think is better. And we have believed that we owe it to the Braille reading population of North America, and maybe even to the world, although we don't want to get too grandiose or too much of a swelled head over this thing. We owe it to people to create a unified Braille code that is better than this idiocy that's come out from Committee 2. And we've set about doing that. We have a list of over 90 people who talk about punctuation marks. We've talked about numbers. We've gone through the whole business of Braille codes from front to back. And we're producing a very different kind of unified code, a very different kind of document than the Committee 2 report. But I think it's a document that shows that a unified code is possible. We all know it's desirable. We're going to show that it's possible. You can base it on lower numbers. We're not enslaved by any means to the Nemeth code. In fact, some people who are Nemeth code advocates are kind of dropping away from us because we're not following Nemeth code enough to suit them. Our purpose is not to recreate the Nemeth code as a unified code, but to create a real unified code that will work for literary Braille or for scientific Braille. And, well, we've got a lot of pages of material. in print with SimBraille, in Braille, and I hope within the next couple of months we'll have something complete enough to really do serious transcription and show how much better our system is. And every principle set out by the Braille Authority of North America, every principle adopted later on by ICEB, we have adhered to and can prove that we have adhered to much more rigorously than the Committee 2 or UBC structure has. In addition to that, we have imposed a number of additional constraints upon ourselves, such as fewer characters, certain other constructs, that make it harder to create a code, but that will make a much better, a much more readable code for people.
The name of the email list on which this project is being designed is BRLZYLX, ZYLX meaning As You Like It. You can join the list by sending blank email to majordomo@telepath.com with the line subscribe BRL_ZYLX in the body of the message. So how does Joe Sullivan react to an alternative unified code being out there for consumers and producers to consider?
Well, I haven't seen the alternative code, although I imagine it's similar to some of the proposals that Abe, of course, put before Committee 2, but I can only guess at that. Yeah, so I can't comment on the code itself, but that's, of course, not exactly what you asked. There's bound to be some influence, but I can't feel that it's going to overweigh the fact that there is a, you know, the Braille Authority itself and the ICEB itself has commissioned this project, and it is being, let's say brought forward in with well, I don't know if there's 100 people involved, but I think that there's probably more than that if you count. Everyone involved in some way or another. It's hard for me to imagine by what process this alternative code will be brought forward, but I think the ICEB is a pretty open-minded organization, and if they want to bring it forward, then, you know, it's a free world, I guess, is what it comes down to. But you know, we have to. We have to have some process, that's what I'm trying to say. Otherwise, there will always be people who like one system versus another. And obviously that'll be true of this alternative as well as of UBC. In a way that, you know, that we need to have a way for things to come together, and that's what the ICEB is there for, and that's what Banner is there for. So, I certainly hope that people understand that you know, there's a need to bring it to conclusion, otherwise it'll just be wrangling forever about what code to have.
Chris Gray believes this code will gain consumer support, firstly because it's better, and secondly because of the open processes involved in the design of the code.
We have a core, what we call a core group, and there are representatives in the core group from the transcribing profession, from teachers who are blind and who teach other blind kids, proofreaders, Braille readers, and Abe Nemeth is our consultant. I'm the moderator. But everything that we talk about in the core group then goes to the main group, the ZYLX group as a whole, and is discussed and debated, and their input is taken into account before the core group moves on or makes any final decisions. It's very much a grassroots, bottom-up kind of organization.
So what of the future for the Unified Braille Code? Will the code currently being completed by the International Council on English Braille be adopted? Should it be adopted? And will those who vigorously oppose it agree to live with the outcome? Bill Poole.
There's a big head of steam for it at the moment. When I went to the General Assembly in Baltimore last year, the only two countries where there was what I would call significant opposition to it were the UK and the US. The US largely, though not wholly, focused on the number question. The UK focused on various things, which I mentioned at the beginning of this interview. But most other countries want it, and there are good reasons for wanting it. It would provide a standard which would enable developing countries, for example, not to have to choose whether to purchase from UK sources or US sources, because the Braille would be the same. It would certainly assist print to Braille translatability of technical material. That's a good thing. So it does have some definite benefits going for it. And it would deal with some situations which aren't properly dealt with in existing code, so that could be done on a piecemeal basis anyway. So if the atmosphere in November was anything to go by, I would say that South Africa and New Zealand and Australia and Canada all very much want it, and Nigeria, who are also there, all very much want it. We do want to try and involve other significant English-using countries like India in these debates, because, you know, the only third world country we had was Nigeria, and we do want some more representation of those, and we're going to take steps to try and do that. And it really does depend on what happens in the negotiations up to June, and then what happens in the subsequent debates and how the public react to it. I have to tell you that from my standpoint, I think a number of arguments are being used to support UBC that won't stand up, that you don't need UBC to solve the problems that they're wanting to solve. But, you know, that there are a lot of people in favour. I've read the evaluation comments from people in different countries, and in South Africa and New Zealand, for example, there's a very large majority of people, I'd say something like 80% in favour of it among the people who commented. So, you know, it's there's still all to play for, I would say.
Chris Gray.
Probably speculation is not a good idea at this point, but I think that by the time 2003 comes, it could mean the dissolution of the Braille Authority in North America, because people are becoming unwilling to contemplate this particular code.
Bruce McGuire.
All of the people involved in the Unified Braille Code project are incredibly dedicated and committed to Braille as the primary literacy medium for blind people. I mean, there is no one in any of the committees that is involved in the project, that are involved with the project, who isn't 100% passionately committed to Braille. And I think that if nothing else comes out of what I've been saying, I think that I would like that to be the thing that people will remember after this interview, that everybody in the project is passionately committed to Braille, and that there is no one who is trying to reduce the importance of Braille, and in fact everyone in the project is trying to increase the importance of Braille as a literacy medium for blind people.
Joe Sullivan outlines the timetable from here.
The ICEB has set a deadline, set a schedule that calls for a decision to be taken in the General Assembly to be held in the fall of 2003. That would I think you consider that a schedule that we're working to at this point. Because that will be, there will also be a significant meeting taking place in the year and a half from now, when the executive committee of the ICEB meets as well. So by that time, we hope to certainly to be well along with the committees having finished their work and be ready to, you know, start to work on such things as, you know, plans as to how some of the activities such as training and so forth are to take place.
Everyone who's spoken on this program agrees that the blind of the English-speaking world would benefit from a unified Braille code. But just as in many examples of unification of all kinds throughout history, the achievement of this important goal is proving difficult. The original 1996 completion date is now well behind us. In the coming months, we'll all be given the chance to actually read this code and to make up our own minds as to whether we can live with learning to do some things differently, or whether the sacrifices we're being asked to make are just too great. This program has been produced in the hope that it will encourage you to visit the websites and participate in the lists that have been mentioned. Read the arguments on both sides and examine the samples. Then, decide for yourself whether the change is good for you and good for the blind of the English-speaking world. After all, this is about the very way we read and write, and what could be more important. I'm Jonathan Mosen, and this has been an ACB Radio Special Report.